With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that New England pound.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood, and I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. This week's episode is the first of a new series called Founders, where we'll be speaking to people who have started companies in video and TV advertising. That's obviously a broad church. It could be ad tech, agencies, media companies. And we'll be talking about their experiences of going about building their businesses. Part of the reason I want to do this is because I think that it's starting a business that is one of the most rewarding things that you can do. And hopefully by having these conversations, we'll be able to demystify the process as much as possible. Ultimately, there's just a human being at the back of these things, and they don't have special magical powers. And so hopefully it might even inspire some other people to do the same and take the plunge. We're kicking off the series with Amy Williams, who is the CEO of a fantastic company called Goodloop. Goodloop, they partner with brands and they reward a charity in exchange for the user's attention whilst watching an ad. So essentially the brand gets engagement whilst promoting their ethical values, and then the charity gets a donation. So pretty much everyone's a winner. Just a bit of housekeeping from us. On March the 18th, that's coming up soon, we're going to be holding a half-day conference in the morning on the future of identity, which I think is an issue that has come to the forefront of people's minds, particularly after the recent Google announcement. But it probably is the big issue facing the agency, facing the industry for 2021. We've got some fantastic speakers, including the legendary Rishad Tabakawala. Rishad was best known probably for his work as Chief Growth Officer at Publicis, and now he's also the author of an excellent book called Restoring the Soul of Business. If you haven't listened to the episode with Rishad, it's worth tracking back to listen to that. We also have Simon McDougall from the ICO, the UK's data regulator. Simon will be joining me to speak about which solutions are or aren't going to be allowed. And he'll also be taking questions from the live audience, which should be very interesting. You can register by going to futureofidentity.videoweek.com. That's futureofidentity.videoweek.com. Okay, so now I'll cross over to my chat with Amy. Hopefully you'll be inspired to launch a business by the end of it. That's if you haven't done so already. And yeah, I hope you enjoy. So Amy, welcome to the Video Week podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So firstly, what motivated you to start a business in the first place? And, you know, do you think there's anything different about people who decide to, you know, leave their job and take the plunge to go it alone?
For me personally, I think it's the arrogance of wanting control. Like, I was working at such a giant advertising agency. You know, it's a global oil tanker, and it gave me such fantastic foundations for my career. It grew my network. It helped me understand the language and the nuance of the industry. Like, I don't think I could have done it without starting off in a big corporation. But the longer I spent there, the less I felt like my behavior mattered. Like, I remember there was one campaign we worked tirelessly, like we were getting sort of takeaway pizzas delivered to the office five nights in a row because we were working so late. And then you get to the end of the campaign and you deliver it for the client, and then you just on to the next one. And I just felt like all of my energy was being plowed into this direction. And I wanted a more direct feedback loop. I wanted to make a decision, to take an action, and I wanted to immediately see the impact of that choice, good or bad. I think I missed some of that thrill of being so close to the action. So that really was what pushed me over the edge and just made me decide to go it alone.
Strangely, you almost to a T explained exactly why I like working for myself. That thing of, I don't think it's arrogance. I think that there is, I think it's quite understandable to, you know, what feel that, you know, what you do matters. And I think some people can get that from larger organizations, but I personally prefer to sort of suffer the direct consequences of my successes and of my failures. You know, if I get something wrong, I'm accountable, and it's, you know, I hold myself accountable to that. And then if you have a success, and you aren't vulnerable to office politics, so if Dave plays golf with John and gets a promotion above you, I think that's another thing. I'm not Machiavellian enough to survive the office politics of a big organization.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So what were you doing? You mentioned you were working at an agency before. What was the agency and what was your role?
So I started my career at Ogilvy, and I was on the Ogilvy graduate scheme, although they called it a fellowship to make it more inclusive, although everyone except me was from Oxford or Cambridge. But in theory, it was a fabulous idea to sort of bring in a more inclusive, more diverse talent pool. I think nowadays they really do achieve that. Ogilvy has some fantastic non-graduate focused talent schemes for young people. And I loved that grad program. Like, it's a rotational program, so you spend 3 years in three different Ogilvy companies across the group. So I was doing packaging, I was doing email comms. I remember one dark day when I sent a British Airways executive email out to the silver tier members in bronze font. Woo, I was in trouble. I learned quickly the importance of the detail. And then my final client, once I had settled into Ogilvy and I'd been there for a few years, I ended up on the Unilever account. And Unilever are obviously a huge account for Ogilvy, and they're also such forward-thinking expert marketeers. They really, in every sense, build such powerful brands. I mean, they have to, right? Soap and toilet cleaner isn't interesting. They have to build brands that people can connect with in a more emotional way. And the thing that Unilever taught me was how to build a brand that matters, how to build a brand that is literally talking about fabric conditioner, but talks about it in a way that builds on something more innate and more human and more base that connects us, that idea of purpose and positivity and impact that can come from our purchase decisions. All of that was informed by my experience at Ogilvy. So I look back very fondly on those years. And it was probably, I think I was there just under 5 years. Yeah, as I say, decided to jump ship and decided I wanted to do my own thing. I had no idea how to do that. So I Googled, I decided to draw the most unusual Venn diagram in the world, which was countries I wanted to go to plus courses I wanted to take. And then there was really only one in the middle, which was a entrepreneurship course in Chile. So I flew to Chile to take a course in entrepreneurship, and literally everyone else there was Chilean, and they were like, what is this random girl from London doing? Are there not courses in London? Like, why are you here? And also awkwardly, because of me, the whole entire 2 month course had to be in English. So I was not popular, but I learned Spanish quickly. I also learned how to build a business model and how to do financial projections and how to pitch to an investor and, you know, all of those practical skills. But I also just spent 2 months just poring over this idea, just rewriting it and writing it again and pitching it and getting it torn down and building it back up. And 2 years of 2 months of really thrashing it about, I came out of that course with a pretty clear picture of what I wanted to build. And honestly, today, Goodloop isn't that different 5 years on.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I haven't seen many courses, entrepreneurship courses. I'm sure they do exist. I haven't really looked around.
Well, it's a bit of an oxymoron. Like, I don't know if entrepreneurship is actually something you can teach. I remember there was an episode of The Apprentice, and Stuart Biggs the Brand, was it? He, one of the contestants for The Apprentice, he said to Alan Sugar, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. And I remember Alan Sugar like scolding him and saying, you can't call yourself that. That's a title you earn. And so I was aware going in that it's a bit ridiculous going into a course that's aiming to teach you how to break free of molds and do something independent that doesn't quite work. But you know what? It was 20 young women like me all wanting to build businesses. And if nothing else, I gained a peer group and I gained a support network, and that has been so valuable.
I think there is genuinely a lot you could potentially learn and fast track. I think a lot of people, myself included, jump into businesses, and for me it was just sort of passion project, and I just literally learn through trial and error, which everyone does. You know, there's no way you can bypass all of it, but I'm sure there were plenty of things, had I, you know, been humble enough to take advice and sit down with some other people, for example, I could have fast-tracked things as opposed to, fumbling my way in the dark for many years. Where did the idea come from? I mean, you mentioned that you sort of came up with it on that course, but, you know, first of all, I think you should explain what Goodloop is, and then, yeah, explain how you sort of came up with this idea.
Sure. So Goodloop is a purpose-powered advertising platform. We distribute creative video programmatically onto premium publisher sites. And then if someone chooses to not press the skip button and engage with the pre-roll for at least 15 seconds, then they unlock a donation funded by that advertiser, and they can choose which charity or project they would like to give the money to. So readers of the New York Times or the Guardian or the Economist, they get to do good for free simply by not skipping a pre-roll. And the advertiser gets a moment of proactive engagement, and then they get to sort of have this very positive moment where the consumer picks the charity. So it's quite interactive ad experience. So ultimately, we drive engagement by giving ad money to charities. And that idea, well, it came from seeing how many brands, especially within Unilever, seeing how many brands were starting to talk about purpose, and seeing how they were starting to convert that into exciting commercial opportunity. You know, Unilever's purposeful brands grow 75% faster than the rest of their portfolio. You know, Adidas's trainers that are made from plastics in the ocean are their fastest selling trainer range ever. Like, there's so many examples where brands are literally selling more soap by doing good. And all of the creative agencies, all of the brand strategists, they're writing these beautiful, empowering decks about the brand purpose. They're making these emotional 3-minute manifesto films. But then when you look at the media side of our industry, which is actually, you know, 90% of a brand's budget, 90% of a brand's influence, the media often forgets those purposeful values. And we have so many issues, from brand safety and ad fraud through to viewability and ensuring that we're not funding hate or misinformation. You know, the media side of advertising is so mired in negativity and opacity. And so Goodloop was really about taking the principles of purpose that I learned from the creative side of our industry, but applying them to media to create these positive moments of value exchange.
So one of the things, you know, when we spoke before, you mentioned that, you know, as a product, you can get pigeonholed as being a bit of a fluffy company with a nice social mission. They're trying to do some good in the world, as opposed to being regarded as a serious commercial proposition. Now, when you said that to me, I was sort of secretly sort of confessed, well, to myself. I didn't say it to you at the time, but I had put you in that box, you know. And the more I thought about it, and once I saw the formats, also for me, I think a big sort of psychological threshold I've crossed in accepting all of this is that you realize that brands are actually serious about this, that it's not just bullshit marketing. It's, you know, it genuinely is becoming quite core to what they do, and they're seeing financial rewards at the end of it as well. And people believe in it, and, you know, it's a massive differentiator in terms of retaining staff, and, you know, not just, you know, it's also internal as much as external. And you're seeing companies actually genuinely incorporate this into their values, which is, I have to say, I'm from the no logo generation, I think, where, you know, you're slightly cynical about what, you know, advertising was up to and marketing was up to. And I think we are actually seeing a real sort of corporate change where these values are actually, it's more than just lip service. So I mean, how do you overcome that, as opposed to, you know, to make people realize that No, actually, there's a serious commercial proposition.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, actually. There isn't really that many examples to date of social businesses also being incredibly globally successful. There are a few. Actually, at the moment, reading Anita Roderick's autobiography, the founder of The Body Shop, and she was a pioneer in the idea of social business, and created such a community around her products because they were all about trust and truthfulness and kindness and love and the things that we so often forget in business. So from the start, a big part of the mission for me on a personal level has been to use Goodloop as an illustration to the world that you can deliver social impact with commercial scale. The two don't have to be an either or choice, and to be able to illustrate that through our own growth and through the growth that we deliver for our clients. We look a lot at the ROI or the value of our campaigns, because as you say, you know, everybody might buy an ethical campaign once to feel warm and fuzzy inside and to have a nice pat on the back and say they did some good. But if we can't show the business uplift, if we can't show the commercial return, they'll never book twice and we'll never grow as a company. And so we run brand uplift studies and we run a lot of very in-depth research on our campaigns to check some of those crucial business metrics. Two areas in particular that often come up for us are differentiation. So looking at where we have clients who are really trying to differentiate through their ethical positioning. A really nice example of this, actually, we worked with Boots brand Soap and Glory. So we ran with them across the UK. And, you know, I've mentioned their biggest competitor already. Like, The Body Shop is such an ethical brand. And then you've got brands like Benefit. You know, the beauty industry is really starting to get disrupted by brands who are more ethical, more community focused, more kind. So Soap and Glory have a lot to answer to, and they worked with us to support the Hygiene Bank. The Hygiene Bank are a UK network of banks that supply hygiene products to those most in need who can't afford it, which obviously during COVID is so, so crucial. So this campaign, it was a really lovely illustration of that two-pronged effect, because we funded thousands and thousands of donations to the Hygiene Bank, but we also had a 90% uplift in the ethical perception of Soap and Glory. And we looked at the sentiment around community and do Soap and Glory care about their customers? And 82% of respondents following the campaign said they agree that Soap and Glory cares about the community and their customers. So that's an example where we really focused on that ethical and effectiveness measure, those two metrics side by side. The second area that we really focus on is purchase intent and consideration, because that's really the aim of the game, right? We're in advertising, we want to sell more Kit Kats. So often we will run brand uplift studies looking at purchase intent. We did a lovely campaign with Bose for their noise cancelling headphones. We drove 40% uplift in purchase, but we also had a 39% uplift in the perception of Bose as a trusted brand. Trust is such an important part of that long-term customer loyalty, that building that more meaningful connection with a consumer. So sort of differentiation and purchase and trust and consideration, these are all fundamental parts of what we talk about with our clients and how we use our ethical incentives to deliver the business results.
Yeah, I can see how the trust side of things. I think particularly for any, actually, I mean, there isn't really a product category where trust isn't massively important, but I think it's certainly brands like Boots, where healthcare is particularly important, I think. And if you sort of feel that you're dealing with an ethical company, I can see how that's going to pay dividends. Looking sort of at our own industry, what do you think of the role that advertising is playing generally in wider society? You know, I mean, is the net effect of what we do as an industry more good than bad? Or, you know, I realise that's a big question. There's lots of different strands.
I was gonna say, what a question.
You know, like, yeah, you just pull out your sort of cost benefit analysis. But I mean, you know, on the whole, yeah, do you feel that as an industry we should be proud of everything? Or, you know, again, it's quite difficult because you can go company by company. But in terms of the net effect, let's do our balance sheet. What do you think?
So it's a tough one. I remember a couple of years ago, I went back to Warwick University where I studied, and I was invited to do a speech about Goodloop and about building my business. And it's the most negative reception I've ever had.
Yeah.
Just because I think I forgot how idealistic uni students are. You know, they haven't had to compromise any of their values. And I came off stage and all they heard was, I'm using ethics to help Coca-Cola sell more Cokes. And there's truth to that, right? I mean, our world, our planet is never going to survive if we keep consuming. And the end goal of advertising is consumption. So at its very heart of my business is a conflict. I say often to my team, we operate in the gray area between good and bad, and we leverage our industry to do the best possible we can with the billions of dollars that flow through it. So there's some pragmatism that we have to approach this with that says, you know, we all could be building wells and we're not, right? But our industry wouldn't work if it didn't change behavior, if it didn't change consumers' attitudes and shape the way our society functions. And that is such a superpower. It can be used for good or evil. And I think there are some really inspiring examples where advertising has helped shape things for the better. You know, if it's advertising electric vehicles, or you know, we work with Bird's Eye a lot, and they do some fantastic work around promoting healthy eating. I know that's been a big focus this year in the UK around obesity, and the government has had lots of attempts to sort of curb the fast food industry and try and get more people eating fruit and veg. And Bird's Eye do that fantastically. All of their marketing is focused around their fruit and veg. They really promote Eat in Full Colour as the brand message, and with Goodloop they fund Veg Power, which is a charity that gets fruit and veg onto kids' plates around the UK. So I would say, you know, as a whole, we are an industry with a huge amount of opportunity and potential to do good. And the other really interesting side of the coin is the idea of a value exchange. You asked, what role does in advertising play in society? Well, often, you know, the ad on the bus shelter is paying to keep our heads dry, and the ad on the newspaper is paying for that journalist. And we work a lot to ensure that Goodloop advertising is funding the free internet, is keeping quality journalism front and center, and is ensuring that we support those really quality, really crucial aspects to our democracy. You know, we work so closely with several publisher partners, and we also really carefully look at our whitelists and our block lists, because when a brand blocks a term like Black Lives Matter or COVID, you're cutting off the oxygen supply to crucial reporting. And that's, you know, if advertising didn't exist, that's got a paywall. If advertising didn't exist, that wouldn't be there for people to consume freely, regardless of income or regardless of what level of society you're at. And I think that's a wonderful thing that advertising gives to society.
Yeah, I think that's often, I think those upsides to the industry in terms of access to information, and, you know, making it equally available to, you know, I remember when I used to teach out in East London years ago when I was a student, and I used to teach part-time, and we could be in a class and we could look up things online and have the same access to national newspapers that anyone else would have. And even today, you know, with paywalls, and I can understand why publishers are choosing paywalls when they can, but you just would have far fewer opportunities for people to be able to inform themselves. And I think we're at a stage where we want as much quality information available as possible. And well done for answering that question without mentioning Facebook once. I think that's quite an achievement. We spoke about Facebook at New Video Frontiers. Let's not go down that path. Okay, let's stay on the founders theme. So, you know, has the process of building a business, has it been easier or harder than you expected?
Oh, man, I don't think I expected anything. I think that's the beauty of going into something blind. You don't know how hard it's going to be. And I've often heard founders say, if I knew how hard it was, I wouldn't have started, but now I'm in too deep. I can kind of relate to that. Although it's always just seemed like one more step forwards, you know. There's tough points, there's really difficult decisions, there's times where, you know, you're looking at the money in the bank account and you're looking at the payroll and the two are about to collide, and that's awful. Like, you can't sleep. Like, there's so many people whose lives are reliant on your decision making. That's a big weight to bear, but it's also such a privilege to be in that position. And you know, I'm so lucky. I feel so lucky every day. The amount I've been able to learn and the people I've been able to work with, I have had such incredible investors and advisors. I think because Goodloop is doing something so positive in an industry that's full of very, very smart, creative, interesting people who are all a little bit jaded and all wanting a bit more, you know, a bit more purpose to what they do, I've found like that has such a gravity and so many amazing, impressive, like astounding, inspirational people have come to me and said, how can I help? You know, how can I get involved? And through that, I've learned so much. I've just tried to be a sponge and absorb it all. I would say the hardest part is perhaps now. I mean, when I started out, it was really just on me whether we succeeded or failed. And I'm a bit of a control freak. And so when everything's just in my control, I can just work all hours. I can just double down and I can just make sure it happens. And then if it doesn't, then I've only got myself to blame. Whereas now, you know, I'm trying to cultivate a team where everyone is empowered and everyone has space to learn and make their own mistakes and also shape the business for themselves and to carve out areas of the business that they want to focus on. And, you know, it's bigger than me now, which is awesome, but it's also way more terrifying because it's sort of like this unwieldy thing that moves in all sorts of different directions without me necessarily being able to hold it all within my two arms. So I'm still trying to get used to that. And I definitely think, yeah, as it's grown and as we've tried to reach scale, the challenges have multiplied, which makes me think it's just going to keep getting harder. So that's good.
Well, it's a difficult balancing act when you're considering, you know, there's the you know, at one end of the spectrum, you know, an intense micromanager. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got people not really feeling they have enough guidance and not quite knowing what they're going to do and that they don't feel supported. And it's quite difficult to get that balance and to anticipate somebody's personality type in terms of what they're, you know, I'd be very much on the type of person where I just like to be left to it as much as possible. And I'll ask for help if necessary, or probably not, being a stubborn man. But I will like that independence, and I think it's quite difficult to work out what the best approach is. I mean, so what for you has been the most challenging decision that you've ever had to make? You know, was there you know, a decision, I'm sure there has been plenty, but where, you know, days where, you know, you really didn't want to be the boss, what was the day? And, you know, and again, I think anyone who's started a business could probably name you quite a few.
There was one particular challenge that was a really tough decision. You know, we've spoke a little already about this idea of the grey area and the good side and the bad side of advertising and how to use that as a force for good. And that, at the sharpest end of those decisions, is the question of which brands will Goodloop work with and which brands will we turn down? Because we have our own brand and our own values, and we also have the reputation of all the charities that we support. You know, we work with hundreds of different charities who all rely on us to protect their brand safety and their reputations. So there really is an important conversation to be had around what are our red lines that we won't cross. And there are some easy ones, right? Like guns. But then there are some really hard ones, like, you know, the soft drinks industry is such a huge, or the fashion industry, such huge consumers of drinking water. But then in other ways, they provide economic empowerment and they provide huge amounts of support through the arts and through, you know, there's loads of different ways that these organisations do have positive impacts. And so anyway, the campaign I'm thinking of is one of the runway expansion campaigns. And the team came to us. They wanted to support the local wildlife. They wanted to support, I think it was the Wildlife Trust in particular, or maybe National Trust. And they wanted to promote the expansion of their runway. So you know, this was obviously last year when runway expansion seemed like a relevant thing to do. Now they're probably quite glad they didn't get it. But anyway, we had a huge commercial opportunity. It was big money. It was an exciting pitch, and someone in our team flagged that they didn't feel comfortable promoting a runway extension. And it was a really tough one, because when you start saying no to some things, where do you stop, you know? And we had this debate. It was quite a heated debate amongst the team, where some people felt really strongly that, you know, if we're promoting extra flights and extra runways, then we're causing climate change. Like, that is, we can't stand up and say that we are a climate neutral company, a carbon neutral company, and also promote that. Where the other end of the spectrum, we work with flight companies, we work with travel companies, so then are we being hypocritical? So anyway, we had a big debate. Everybody in the team read up on it, and we put all of it in a big resource dump where we could read each other's links. And then we had a democratic vote, and everybody in the team got a say, everybody had a voice. And as a group, we decided to turn down the campaign. And we decided that our line on it was, you know, if BA is going to fly somewhere, well, we want to help fill all those seats, right? But when an airport is extending its runways, it's going to increase the number of flights. So it's a more direct cause of carbon emission. Oh, that was tough. Like, there's so many strong personalities in my team, and everybody cares so passionately. And I never want that to be a negative. I love how passionate everyone is. In fact, it's one of our key culture values. It's one of the things we recruit for, is people that really give a shit about the world, people that have their own areas of impact or volunteering or you know, cause areas that they feel passionately about. And so for me, that debate was both the thing that's most beautiful about Goodloop, but it was also a difficult decision that any regular advertising company would never have had to make.
Yeah, I can see that being, it's a great example of a dilemma where I can see, you know, being massively commercially interesting, but then having the ethical dilemma where you can't see which way. I was sort of thinking through which side would I have been on. And I think with a company like yours, I think, yeah, I can see why, in terms of maintaining your own values, even just for your own business interests, even just on a commercial basis, I think it was probably the right decision not to do it. But I can see how it would be quite interesting. I'm the classic case of a person who, I'm all for tackling climate change, but the rules don't apply to me when it comes to when I want to fly somewhere.
But I'm still going on holiday, right?
yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, and the only reason I'll sort of jump on a train to Cologne for to Mexico is when I'm being lured on there with free drinks.
That's normal. That's okay. That's humans, and we're never going to fix this problem if we can't do it in a way that suits humans. It won't work.
Exactly. I'm inclined to agree. So how did you go about, you know, the process of building a team? And, you know, how would you describe the culture at Goodloop? You just mentioned there that, you know, people are quite value driven, and, you know, often have voluntary experience and that type of thing behind them. But be interested in how you manage that, and then balancing that with the commercial side.
Yeah, culture is really important to me, and I've really enjoyed thinking about it and building it. So the thing that kicked off our formal culture building was we ran a workshop with the team about 3 years in, and everybody had to write on post-it notes, if you were going to hire someone tomorrow, what were the attributes that would make them the perfect fit? Like, how would you describe them in terms of that perfect hire? And then we took all those post-its and we distilled them down and down until we got to three key attributes for someone we were going to hire tomorrow that would be the perfect fit and complement all of the things that we valued most in the existing team members. And it came to basically being nice people, kind, decent humans. That was sort of value one. The second was really giving a shit about the world, really giving a shit about the problems and how to address them. And, you know, we don't all have to be passionate about the same thing. There are some people in my team who are real climate activists, and there are others who work very closely with the LGBTQ community. And there are some who are just passionate about their local community. And you know, all of that is beautiful and important, but it's really about building a culture where there's, you know, space within the workplace to have that passion. We also take a lot of our clients volunteering. We work really closely with the charities we support. We've raised well over a million now for all sorts of charities, from beach cleanups to human rights campaigns. So there really is something for everyone. And then the final sort of value that we identified was this sense of always questioning how we can be better, of never staying still. And I think that one is particularly true of me and Daniel, the founders of Good Loop, always really never being happy, I suppose, always trying to push ourselves to be better. But that sort of summarizes it. And I try not to force it. I don't think a culture can be forced. I don't think you can make people fit in a box. All you can do is say, these are the things that as a collective group we agree that matter. How you interpret that, how you put that into your day-to-day work is your choice. But on an annual basis, we do a 360 review, and you're reviewed based on those values and how you, in your own way, reflect them.
Yeah. So what do you think we can do to encourage more female founders in the industry? I always feel a little bit guilty, because I'm always asking women about diversity and all the rest of it. But I think a lot of the time when you're speaking to senior women, they often feel quite passionate about it. And anyway, but it's not something I ask men, generally speaking. But like, one of the things that, you know, when it comes around to, you know, CEO lists, or you want to do a CEO panel, it's often really difficult to find female founders, particularly, or even female CEOs if you're looking at the ad tech side. But what do you think? What do you think we can do to encourage more?
Yeah, it's funny. Things like Demexco and ATS London, you know, all of these big ad tech events, there's often like a women's breakfast or something, and I'll go along and there'll be like 10 of us in a room, and we'll have a croissant, and then we'll go downstairs and there'll be like 700 men. Yeah. We're like, oh, can we go back to our breakfast, please? Oh God, it's such a male industry. And that's a consequence of many things. It's no one's fault. It can't be helped. It's really just about being aware of it. And I think, you know, at a very young age, girls are encouraged to do other subjects rather than STEM, rather than focus on science and technology. And so from a really young age, we're already losing a lot of brilliant women. And then you come into the industry, and so many of those softer skills that are traditionally encouraged in women, such as collaboration and creativity and teamwork, they are less valued, they're less heard. You know, we've talked already about how certain voices are going to speak louder. And if we don't change the structures within which people are heard, then we can just let people get drowned out. And so within the peer group, there's lots to be done to make sure that the female, I wouldn't say just women, but the feminine perhaps characteristics of us are all celebrated and appreciated and given space. And then, you know, at a senior level, one thing I've found incredibly important is to have mentors and to have people that you can see ahead of you achieving it. You can be what you see. I really believe that. I really do. I mean, there are some iconic women in our industry that I have really been driven by. Things like Karen Blackett or Sarah Wood, you know, who have smashed the ceilings ahead of me and who've made me feel less alone. So I think giving those women a platform, things like this, where you're doing a podcast and giving, you know, equal platform to men and women, giving platform to diverse voices, those acts are so, so valuable, because you don't know who's listening.
Yeah, true. And the role model thing of monkey see, monkey do, you know, even for me as an Irish person, is something I've lived through, as we saw, you know, I think in the 1980s Ireland, we sort of had very sort of low self-esteem as a country. And, you know, it's something that sort of stayed in my brain even to this day, you know, where we're at the bottom of all the economic charts. But then living through U2 being the biggest band in the world, our international football team did extremely well by our standards, and we're getting to sort of quarterfinals and things. And then Ireland becoming City of Culture, just lots of different things that were signaling to you that, you know, you can do just as well. And now, you know, Ireland's doing extremely well for itself, but it was very much a confidence thing. And that residual thing of where you were sort of, it was communicated to you or inferred that you weren't capable of such things.
Right. Stays with you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, I love that point. I think that's really relevant to the female experience of those little wins that really boost you. I've had a couple of debates with female founders about how to approach these sort of special bonuses that we get as female founders, because we're so few and far between. We'll often get press opportunities like, have you met these 10 inspiring women in media, you know? and the only reason we're on that list is because of our gender. And often there are female focused investment groups or female focused mentoring sessions. And I've had debates with other women who are leaders that feel patronized and feel infantilized by these kinds of paternal support networks. But I think it really reflects what you were describing, Vincent, where these little wins, like being in that list or being in the Adweek top 100 women or getting to that angel network that invest in female founders, they are remedial actions that help boost a much needed voice. And I'm going to take every bloody opportunity I get, because I'm fighting so hard to be heard. I'm fighting so hard to be on a level playing field. And I'm going to make no apologies for using every opportunity at my disposal to ensure that we get that equal footing.
I think you're absolutely right too, you know. And you know, if you get an MBE, so be it. I'd be all over it. I'd be straight out to the Queen. It's just mentioned about the fundraising side of things. How difficult was that? That was a question that this sort of indicates that this is our first one of these, but I probably should have asked you about that process of raising money and raising capital. It's often presented as being quite a daunting thing. How did you go about raising money for your business?
Sure. So we've done a couple of different rounds. On our cap table now, we have a range of different investors. We have independent angel investors. We have angel syndicates, friends and family. We did a crowdfunding round as well. And we also have some funds. I have a social impact fund called SISV. And we also have You and Mr. Jones, who are a brand tech fund founded by David Jones, the ex-CEO of Havas. So everything really from industry funds through to impact investment. And it's been a really interesting, at times very challenging journey. There's a lot of rejection, like so much rejection. I have a spreadsheet of all the investors that I speak to each round, and the list at the bottom in red are the people that say no, and I put them in red and I put the reason they say no. And at the beginning, you know, you start with a few lines and then you get to maybe 10 lines and then starts to look about 50-50 black and red on the spreadsheet. And then by the time I closed my round, I had to do like 6 scrolls to get to the bottom of the red section. Like, there were so many no's, and each no is really personal, because they're telling you the reasons why your business will fail. They're telling you the reasons why it would be a stupid investment. And so with each no, your confidence takes this little hit, and you have to go and lick your wounds and then go back out and get ready for the next no. It's honestly the most character building thing I've ever done. But the wonderful thing about it is that it's basically about telling a story. It's telling a story that encompasses where you've been and makes people believe in where you're going and makes them want to be a part of where you're going. And I think storytelling is such an important skill in leadership, important in growing a business. You know, whether you're attracting talent or customers or investors, if you've got a powerful story, then you'll make people want to join you. And I love that part of the job. I love telling people about Goodloop and sharing the vision and seeing them get excited about what we could do.
Yeah, and I would never take, I mean, I think those criticisms, of course, you're going to take those criticisms to heart, as would any human being who's got an idea and is being judged. But I think quite a few of the most successful founders I've seen in ad tech were people who I thought, they don't really know a huge amount about the industry, or weren't even that interested in the wider industry, or, you know, they wouldn't know the things that I know and the people I know. And I'd kind of judge them a bit on, you know, do they really know what they're doing? And they've turned out to be like the most successful founders, where they've gotten, they've stratospheric revenues, because it was more their growth was more about their personality traits and their vision for growing a big company. And they sort of had that startup mentality and that self-belief to grow something, and they had other people who were savvier, but there were people who, there are people, for example, like Brian O'Kelly or Boris at IponWeb, who, you know, are the, were those, you know, first people who were sitting around coding long, you know, years and years before anyone else had heard of real-time bidding. They were working on it. But you really don't have to be one of those to be successful. You know, that's my feeling from based on what I've seen. I don't want to name names, but like, but so many of the there were people who literally did not have a clue about the industry and did fantastically well. But
totally, I totally agree. I mean, the secret that we all hold that we don't want to tell people is advertising is actually quite simple.
Yeah.
If you're smart and you're keen to learn, you can figure it out.
Yeah.
The tough part is having the resilience to keep going.
Yeah, no, I completely. I think that is there. There's some Steve Jobs quote about that, about it being more about persistence than anything else. You know. So you know. Just the final question. In terms of you inspiring other people, do you have any media recommendations? It can be a good book that influenced you. It could even be a podcast or an online video. Anything. What would you recommend to other founders, or current or otherwise?
Okay, so I actually am really enjoying Anita Roderick's book. I haven't finished yet, so if the end is terrible, then don't blame me. But the first half is great. I mean, she is such a pioneer in terms of building a business with none of the traditional rules of what a business should look like. And the Body Shop today is still, you can see ripples of her impact and her stories, you know, the way she told stories, they resonate through the business today, even though she's unfortunately not with us. So I think that's a very inspiring book I would really recommend. This one's not linked to our industry at all, but the other day I watched Biggest Little Farm. It's a film, well, it's a documentary made by a filmmaker who moves out of the city, buys a plot of land, and then builds an entirely self-sufficient natural farm. Oh my God, I cried, I laughed, I had a great time. I was like, right, I'm leaving London, I'm going to go live in Shropshire. It was so inspiring. Just if you need to not think about completed view rates and viewability for 10 minutes, go and watch this film, because the message I took out of it is, no matter how complicated and stressful and stupid our world gets, nature has a system, nature has a plan. Like, the way he builds this whole farm, and he doesn't use any chemicals, he doesn't kill any pests. And at the beginning, the pests are killing all his crops, right? The snails are ruining his fruit trees. But then he realizes that his ducks can eat the snails, and then the ducks get fed and the fruit trees blossom. And then, and it all, nature just works it all out. And it's such a reassuringly simple and beautiful film. And I just felt so wholesome afterwards.
What's it called again?
Biggest Little Farm.
Biggest Little Farm. And is it on any of the platforms or whatever else? I really want to watch this.
Yeah, honestly do. I think it must be. I can't remember where I watched it now, but I'm sure if you Google it, it'll come up.
Yeah, I've been following farmers a lot on Twitter during lockdown, where I'm completely craving the simplicity of their life. Even on their really bad days, where they're like, a dog got in and stressed the sheep, and they're angry. It just feels quite reassuring.
You're gonna love this film.
Yeah, it's like they're outside. The last chapter of Anita Roderick's book, by the way, she reveals that she was testing on animals all along. It's a great conclusion. It's a great twist. No, not at all. I completely agree with you. I think the Body Shop were fantastic in the way that they pioneered so much when so many people didn't even sort of comprehend the idea of incorporating those kind of values into their business. And where it was very much the forerunner for so many of them today. Amy, thanks so much for joining. This was a fantastic first episode of these new founder series, and I'm sure we'll be in touch soon.
Thanks for having me.